Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen, and on today's show, we have an interview with Dr. Ellington Darden. Now, Dr. Ellington Darden was very well known for working with Arthur Jones and with the Nautilus Company. He wrote many, many books about Nautilus and about high-intensity training. And before that, Dr. Darden was also a competitor, and he competed in the 60s and the 70s against some very well-known bodybuilders like Boyer Coe and Casey Viator and Dennis Tenorino and Jim Haslop. So we're going to talk to Dr. Ellington Darden about those early days of bodybuilding, and then we're going to get into a discussion about his relationship with Arthur Jones and his books that he wrote, and talk about some high-intensity training, and we're going to talk about genetics. We're going to talk about a lot of good things. All right, before we get to that, I do want to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can reach them at their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. And if you mention that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, they will give you a free consultation and they will give you 20% off your order. All right. So what else is going on, guys? I've got my fall fitness challenge. It is officially up on the johnhansenfitness.com website. So if you want to get in shape before the end of the year, this is your chance. So we're going to start actually next week. The 28th of September, and we will go all the way up until December 21st, which is perfect because it's right before Christmas. So you will have 3 months, 12 weeks to completely transform your body. And I think this is great for a few reasons. First of all, most people wait until January 1st to get into shape. This is kind of the part of the year where they kind of slack off. Now it's football season. Football is being played even with this coronavirus. And people kind of relax, and most places in the country, it gets cold. And so people just try to bundle up, get a little fat, and then they get ready for the holidays, which is Thanksgiving and Christmas. So then they just eat tons of food then. And then after the new year, that's when they say, okay, now I'm going to get in shape. What I'm offering is this fall fitness challenge to get into shape now. So you will be in fantastic condition before Christmas. Think about that. So when Christmas comes along and you have to go to your holiday parties or you're visiting your family, maybe you're traveling, you are going to be ripped and in awesome shape. And that's pretty awesome. And then you'll also be in great shape for New Year's. And then when the New Year starts, you don't have to go through the challenges that everyone else is going to go through and making New Year's resolutions and try to go through that dieting phase and get in shape. You'll already be there. So that's really, really a great advantage. The other advantage is, of course, you know, this year has been a terrible year for most of us. 2020 has been not a great year because of the coronavirus, because of all the restrictions we've had on us. So what a great way to end the year by ending it on a positive note. So basically, these fall fitness challenges is just going to be like my other fitness challenges of the year. When you register, I will send you out a questionnaire, and then I will design a new workout and a new diet based on whatever goals you have. Most people just want to lose weight and maintain their muscle or even build a little muscle. Some people want to bulk up and build muscle. Whatever your goal is, I will design a workout and diet program specifically for that. These are not cookie cutter routines. They are customized for everybody. And then I'll be your fitness coach for the next 12 weeks. So I'll check in with you every week. And you send me pictures on the first week along with your measurements. And then every 4 weeks, you'll send me pictures. So after 4 weeks, you'll send me pictures, 8 weeks. And then finally, at the last week, which will be the 12th week, you'll send me the pictures. And then I'll compare your before and after pictures. I'll also compare your measurements. And whoever shows the most improvement can win prizes. We've got free supplements from Old School Labs, $200 in supplements for first place, I think $100 for second, $75 for third. And then I also have my books and my DVDs, which I will give out to all the winners, the top three winners. And then everybody who signs up, the first 10 people who sign up, will get a free bottle of Vintage Burn, which is the fat burner from Old School Labs. So that is what we got going on, guys. And I hope you take advantage of it because it's really a great deal. You're going to have 3 months of personal consultation. And like I said, I'll be your coach each week. So you can email me, text me, whatever you want. And I will check in with you every week for sure, just to make sure you're losing weight. And if you're not, then I will change up your diet or I will change up your training, because the goal is to have the biggest change from the beginning to the end. So we are starting next week. So just go to johnhansonfitness.com if you want to sign up for that. It's right there on the front page. And just click the link and you can sign up and get it going. And you'll be in awesome shape. I've done that a few times before in my life where I dieted, usually for competitions, and I was in great shape by the time Christmas comes around. You really do feel awesome because everybody else is fat. Everybody else has been eating for the whole fall. And then the Christmas season, they really get fat and everybody just says, ah, screw it. They don't even care. And they just go for it and just start eating and they look like shit. So this way, it's really, really a great feeling to end the year in great condition. And then when you start January 1st, like I said, you don't have to go through all those New Year's resolutions and all those challenges because you'll already be there. So that's what I'm offering to you guys. So if you want to check that out, johnhansonfitness.com, and you can sign up. And I hope we get a lot of you guys. We will have also the winners this week on johnhansonfitness.com. And we got Armando Requina was the winner. And Mark Johnson was second. And Caleb Maston was third. So you'll be able to see the pictures and hear the stories from those guys and what they went through. They all made great changes. I think Caleb lost like 7 inches off his waist. Amato made incredible progress. I think he only lost 5 inches, but it looks like 10. He just looked totally different from the before and after picture. Mark really did an amazing transformation because he actually gained muscle while he was losing the fat. His waist was actually bigger than his chest when he started. And then when he finished, his chest was 3 inches bigger than his waist. So it's really cool to see these amazing transformations. You don't have to be a veteran. You don't have to have been training for years and years. Some of the guys who did this last challenge, they were just starting off. One guy never even weight trained before. He lived in Tampa, and I went to the gym with him, and I showed him what to do. So you don't have to be doing this for a long time in order to really change your body. And then this is just to get going. These first 3 months, you will completely change your body. You won't be done, of course, but it'll really get you going. And if you do this fall fitness challenge, you'll be ready to go by the new year because you'll already be in fantastic shape. All right. I did see some bad news today on the internet. Helmut Reidmeier, who was, of course, a great bodybuilder from Germany, competed with Arnold Schwarzenegger. He competed in the NAVA Mr. Universe. He also competed in the IFBB Mr. Universe. He posted something saying his good friend Carl Bloomer fell asleep peacefully on Saturday, September 19th, and he left us. He would have been 83. He's got these dates backward because he's European, but I think it's October 12th. He would have been 83. So rest in peace, Carl Bloomer. I know I've talked about him on my bodybuilding history series that I just started on my YouTube channel because Carl was in a lot of competitions. If I'm not mistaken, I think Carl won the tall class at the 1971 IFBB Mr. Universe that was held in Paris, along with Mr. Olympia that year. And Albert Beckles won the medium class and the overall. And I think Giuseppe Diana won the short class from Italy. But I'm pretty sure Carl Bloomer beat a lot of good competition to win the tall class that year. I know he was also in the NAVA Universe. So rest in peace. Carl Bloomer, another legend, has left us. All right. We did get some emails. Oh, before I get to that, I want to keep you guys up to date because I know a lot of people have emailed me about that test I had to go through for my liver. If you'll remember, I was going to get my hernia surgery done this year because the one I had done last year, didn't work or it didn't last or had the hernia back again. So I had to go back and see the doctor and make an appointment for a surgery to get it fixed again. And they were going to put mesh in this time. But before they did that, they did a CT scan to see exactly where the hernia was located. And they found two lesions on my liver. So I actually had to go see an oncologist after getting an MRI. And the oncologist was going to go over the MRI with me. So that was kind of freaky. I never went to anybody about cancer before. But turned out to be nothing. He said they're very, very small, nothing to worry about. I think they're benign. They're not even cancerous. So he said a year from now, I'm going to get checked out again and get an MRI again. But he showed it to me on the MRI, and they were so small, looked like a pinprick. So I really don't think it's anything to worry about. So I'm going to probably talk to my doctor this week, and I will schedule another hernia surgery and probably get that done hopefully before the end of the year. So thanks to all of you who have emailed me and sent me their concerns about how I'm doing. I appreciate you guys doing that. All right. We also put the Vinny Galante interview from last week on my YouTube channel under John Hansen. So if you're on YouTube, check out my channel and subscribe to it. And got the Vinny Galante interview that we did on our podcast up as a video as well. So this first email actually is from Mark Johnson. Mark was second place in the Summer Fitness Challenge and said, "Hey, John, it was such an incredible news to be rewarded second place in your Summer Fitness Challenge. I feel as if I'm in good company with my two favorite bodybuilders and uncrowned Mr. Olympia winners, Serge Nubre and Muhammad McAway. John, this was a life-changing experience for me, and it's still hard to explain to others how much I've learned about myself and the discipline it takes to achieve a brand new physique. Every time I look in the mirror, I'm amazed at where this challenge has brought me, and I now wake up every day excited to make further progress and improvements. I could never have done it without you. Thank you for your support. Thank you for your wisdom, and thank you for sharing your love of bodybuilding with all of us. We're all richer by far for it." All right, Mark, thank you very much for that email. That's great hearing from him about how much it made a change in his life and how excited he is about his physique. And you got to go through a little bit of discipline with the diet and the training, but man, it really, really works. And it definitely pays off. So congratulations to Mark for that. All right, I got another email here from Andrew. And he says, "Hey, John, another great episode of Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Nice to hear from an old school bodybuilder like Vinny Galante, who still has the drive to compete. Very impressive. I wanted to add a small bit to the discussion of the time under tension approach. Much of the effectiveness of this training strategy comes from reducing the stretch reflex. When you lower a weight quickly, the working muscle and the attached tendons work like an extended bungee cord, snapping back into place and helping you propel the weight upward. When you lower the weight slowly and you pause in the stretch position, this effect is greatly reduced, forcing the muscle to work that much harder when you lift the weight. This is why bouncing out of a squat, say, is so much easier than lowering the weight slowly. Your muscles are doing much more of the work. Both approaches have their place. A faster lift allows you to move more weight. It also refines the stretch reflex, which can be useful if you're trying to run faster, jump higher, or develop more agility. But for bodybuilders, a slow eccentric with a pause in the stretch position forces the muscles to work harder and may stimulate more growth, even if you wind up using less weight. As Vinny mentions, the time under tension also reduces strain on the joints and connective tissue, which is a huge boon for lifters who have a few decades in the gym behind them." And then he says, "Final thought, I suspect you'll read this on the air," which I am. "So this is going out to your listeners. John waits until the very end of each episode to plug his Patreon page. As one of his proud Patreon supporters, I'm going to make the plug right now for everyone to go to Patreon and subscribe for a few bucks a month. If you can find Bodybuilding Legends on your podcast app, you can find it on Patreon. John is doing an incredible service honoring the old school athletes, and he deserves more support for it. Go do it. Thanks again, John. Keep up the great work." All right, Andrew, thank you very much. And thanks for the plug for Patreon. I do appreciate you supporting us every month as well. And then I also got a letter here from Ron Dunn. And Ron says, "John, as I enjoy listening to your Legends interviews and picking my way through the old ones, I just felt the need to drop a few comments and kudos. I enjoyed the two interviews with Ed Connors. I knew of his name as one of the Gold's owners, but I had no idea how prominently he figured into helping so many bodybuilders through the 80s and 90s. And his insights into the marketing of Gold's and creating the Mecca is great info, regardless of what you're into. The Roger Callard interview from 2017 was quite interesting. I had no idea he was such an all-around athlete. He had some great stories, though I'm not sure I believe them all. Arnold buying his Cavs in Mexico. Also, in that one, you gave your top three at the 81 Olympia, and I completely agree. I haven't encountered anyone else who had a Platts calendar, then Padilla, 1, 2, 3. Even though I've never competed, I feel like I have a great artist eye, and I can assess bodybuilders and bodies in general very accurately. But I was not at the contest and have only studied the photos, so it was great to hear your take as you were there. I heard a lot of guys say Danny should have won, but he was just too small. Shredded for sure, but his customary fullness and roundness was not there. Have a great weekend, Ron Dunn. All right. Thank you, Ron. And Ron, I should also mention, is a great artist. And he just recently designed some really cool T-shirts that he was sending out for that he made for Don Howarth. And Don, I guess, is a little bit down on his luck. He needs a little bit of money. So Ron did that for Don Howarth for free and is selling them on one of the sites on Facebook. And they're trying to sell these T-shirts to help make some money for Don. So I'll get that information on that, where they're selling those next week, if anyone wants to contribute. All right. And on my YouTube page, I did the Vinny Galante interview as a video, and I did get some comments. Mark said, can we get Pierre Van der Westholzen? He's a NABBA guy from the 90s. Yeah, I never heard of Pierre, but I'll look into that. Joseph said, Vinny looks like he could still compete. Very impressive for his age. Well, he does still compete. I think he's competing again next year. Alex Ardente said, I love Vinny. He's the star of Supps, the movie. So Alex Ardente has a new movie out. It's like a documentary about the supplement industry called Supps, the movie, S-U-P-P-S. And I think you can get it on Amazon. I still haven't seen it yet, but I think you have to pay for it. It's not one of the free ones. But I may check that out this week. Andrew said, Vinny reminds me of Rich Gaspari. Golden Era 78 said, I'm a Jersey guy, so every time I hear AAU memories of three contests in the late 70s in Orange, New Jersey, or around, great times and special because I never competed again. Ronan said, I really enjoyed this one, guys. Vinny is still in serious shape. I'd love to hear you interview Greg Valentino, John, and I'm hoping for that Charles Claremont interview. Rosario said, Vinny is our legend. Lee Van Cleef, not the Lee Van Cleef, but... Lee Van Cleef said, good interview. Dude seems like a real good guy. John, your show is spectacular. Rob said, I've always incorporated slower negatives from time to time, but slow positives. Interesting. Richie said, I would like to see guys like Bill Pearl or Jim Haislop on your podcast. Stefano said, you used to have to win contests to get in the magazines unless you were Victor Richards. James Lucas said, really great to hear from Vinny that he's embracing and enjoying bodybuilding again well into his 50s. Great physique. Train smarter, not harder. Paul said, hi, John Hansen. Your channel is awesome. This is the first time I've ever heard of this bodybuilder, Vinny Galante. I have never been a fan of Arnold, who feeds off his hype and huge ego. I only follow Frank Zane, Danny Padilla, and Lee Priest, all amazing bodybuilders, offering to us the best of both worlds in bodybuilding physiques. Best of the best on their day of the competition. I'm a new follower of Vinny Galante. As soon as I finish writing this reply to your awesome video on Mr. Vinny Galante, I will seek out his YouTube channel and subscribe to his bodybuilding legend I never knew was around. Respect to you both. From Perth, Australia. All right. Thank you, Paul. All right. Thanks, guys, for your emails and your input on that. If you, like I said, if you want to make a comment on my videos, just go to my YouTube page, which is under John Hansen. If you want to email me directly, I'll read your email on the air. And that is under naturalolympia@gmail.com. I also want to send a shout out to my sister, Kim, for celebrating her birthday this last week. I think it was on the 16th, which was Wednesday. So my sister is now in her 50s. Probably doesn't want me saying that, but I don't think she listens to the show, so she won't know about it anyways. But happy birthday to Kim, and I hope she had a good one. I know she's very busy. She's a mother and works full-time as a hairdresser, so she has a very busy life. But hopefully she got to get out and enjoy it a little bit. Got a couple interviews hopefully coming up in the next couple weeks with some old-school 80s bodybuilders. I won't mention their names yet, but I'll let you guys know about that when they happen. These guys aren't big names, but they did compete in the 80s. So sometimes we have some really good interviews when we talk to guys like that. All right. So that is it for our opening. Here is our interview with Dr. Ellington Darden, where we're going to talk about the old days of bodybuilding. Speaking of the old days of bodybuilding, the 1960s, the 1970s. And then Dr. Darden is going to talk about his relationship with Arthur Jones and all the work he did for Nautilus, including writing many, many books. All right, here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. My guest this week is Dr. Ellington Darden. And Dr. Darden was a big participant in the bodybuilding world back in the 60s and 70s. Competed in some real legendary shows against some real icons in the sport. And then he went on to work with Arthur Jones for Nautilus and wrote several books. So, Ellington, it's great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks, John. Orlando, where are you?
I'm in Tampa.
Tampa, all right, so not far away.
No, I didn't know you lived in Orlando. That's interesting. Yep. Okay. So where did you grow up, Ellington? How did you get involved in bodybuilding when you were a kid?
Well, I grew up in Conroe, Texas. It was about 40 miles north of Houston.
Okay.
It was a small town, 10,000 people in the town, and I wanted to be a football player as well as a basketball, baseball. I wanted to, you know, back then in the 50s and 60s, what was admired was an all-around athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And the people in high school that I admired were the ones that could play football, baseball, and basketball, could do all three sports. And people like Doak Walker, who was an All-American football player for SMU in the late 40s, he could not only play those sports, but he ran track and was good in tennis and swimming. I think he was the first six-time letterman ever in what we call the Southwest Conference back then. So
wow.
I wanted to be good in sports, and I was about 5'10" and weighed 130 pounds. I was skinny, and so I wanted to be bigger and stronger. And when I was in the eighth grade, I guess that was about 1957 or so,
mm-hmm.
We had a new football coach that came into the high school, and he brought some Healthways barbells. He had about 10 sets of them, and most of them were at the high school, but there were three that he brought over to the junior high school, and we had an old coach there that had been in the military, and he lined us up out in the open field with three barbells, and we had about 15 guys behind each one, and you'd do curls or you'd do presses. You'd rotate around. So
That
was my introduction. I liked it back then.
Yeah, back then, they didn't want athletes lifting weights, right? So that was probably unusual. That's true.
But we had such skinny guys on our team that I think the coach, who was in from West Texas, figured that he had to do something to get the guys bigger and stronger. And it didn't work on most people because they didn't stick with it.
Mm.
I stuck with it. And that next summer, I bought a barbell set from the local sporting goods store,
mm-hmm.
and set it up in my garage and, you know, did the old Healthway courses of you had 12 exercises and you did one set of 8 to 10 reps or whatever. You know, I followed the program carefully for the whole summer.
Right.
Started putting on some muscle.
Okay. So what was your genetics like for bodybuilding? I mean, were you putting on muscle pretty quickly or was it a struggle?
Yeah, my mother was 5'10" and had broad shoulders.
Okay.
My father was 5'6", but he also had broad shoulders.
Okay.
So I had, better than average genetics, and I worked at it consistently. So I put on about 15 pounds every year for the next 5 or 6 years.
Oh, wow.
During the summer. And when I was a senior in high school, I weighed 193 pounds.
Wow, that's pretty big.
Which was big then. I mean, you know, we had like 400 people in our high school, And there might have been two or three of them guys that weighed over 200 pounds.
Yeah.
But two of the three were fat, you know. So right. A 200-pound or even 190-pound athlete was considered to be big and strong then. And that's what I wanted to be, big and strong.
Right. How did your athletics improve then when you started weight training?
I got letters in four sports. I had 13 letters in high school, which I think is still the record probably.
Oh, no kidding.
So I was pretty good in all of the major sports and went to Baylor University in 1962 and played football for 2 years. And that kind of spurred me to go into bodybuilding because there was a bodybuilding gym there in Waco, Texas, that I joined and got a lot of learning from.
Okay. What was the gym like back then, Ellington? That had to be pretty wild for way back then.
Well, there wasn't much going on in the gym.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of this guy, his name was Ed Cook, C-O-O-K. He came in every afternoon. His wife ran the gym during the day.
Okay.
And he came in the afternoons, and I'd work out with him. He had won some major contests and come close to winning some regional contests. And he had a real good physique and this, you know, very muscular, good abdominals. And I would go around to the shows with him starting in 1964. They had, in Texas, they had some junior or novice contests. So I entered five or six novice contests before I finally won.
Okay.
Moved up the ladder. So that was kind of interesting, yeah.
Tell me about the shows back then, Ellington, because I heard all these stories about how the AAU used to hold contests back in the 60s. They used to do it after the weightlifting, and they would just have that one little light bulb hanging from, you know, you'd have to stand on the posing platform with the light.
Yeah. Yeah, most of these contests were held in a basketball court, usually in a YMCA-type setting.
Okay.
And you're right. They had a spotlight above hooked to the basketball goal. And you had to go out and do your posing that way. There would be 8 or 10 guys in the contest, and it was usually after a powerlifting meet. In Texas in 1964 through 1970, powerlifting was getting to be a major undertaking. And there were a lot of really good powerlifters in Dallas, which was 100 miles from Waco. So I frequently would go up and see them, and I got involved in powerlifting for 5 or 6 years too.
Okay.
And back then you'd do both. You'd enter the powerlifting contest, and then you'd compete in the bodybuilding show afterwards.
Oh, really? Okay.
A lot of people did. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you do that?
Yeah, I did that. I won some powerlifting contest in the novice level.
Okay. Cool.
And that was the first. That's where I met Boyer Coe.
Okay.
Was in 1964 in Dallas. He was like 17, and he came down and entered the powerlifting contest as well as the physique. And I was sitting right by him as we were getting between our lifts, and I was pretty strong then. I could do about 320 or 25 pounds in a bench press.
Okay.
And here came this 17-year-old kid from Louisiana, and he could do like 385.
Wow.
You know, he was 3 or 4 years younger than me.
Wow.
And not very talkative, just very serious.
Uh-huh.
And, man, I just remember, John, sitting beside him looking at his triceps. They were just hanging down. You know, he's 17.
Jeez, 17 years old.
Every time he moved his arm, man, those muscles just rippled.
Wow.
And when they had the contest, the physique contest later that night, oh, man, he just exploded, you know, when he posed.
Yeah, that's the type of physique he had.
You know, I was telling somebody recently that I've been around a lot of big, strong bodybuilders, including Sergio Oliva, Dorian Yates, Larry Scott. But when I think back, the guy that impressed me the most was Boyer.
Wow.
At 17, because, gosh, you know, I would have given almost anything to look like he did at 17. And he was just soft-spoken. He never said much.
Right.
And, you know, later we became very good friends. And,
right. Did he win the contest that day, the bodybuilding show?
No, he got second to Charles Estes.
Okay.
He was a big 6'4" guy from Tennessee.
Wow.
Estes was about 25 or 26, and I think he got in the top five in the Mr. America contest that year.
Okay.
Charles Estes, yeah. But next, the Mr. Texas contest, which was held about 6 months later, Boyer did win.
Wow, really?
1965 Mr. Texas.
And he was 17 then, 18 something?
I think he was 18, yeah.
Wow, that's great.
Texas was one of the few states in the 60s that you could come from outside and win the state contest.
Okay.
But nobody did that, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the guys that came from New York or Alabama or New Mexico or Oklahoma, they were all Texas judges, and the Texas judges didn't like the fact that
he was from out of state.
He's out of state, so most of them didn't place.
Yeah, okay.
Well, Boyer came over there at age 18. He didn't know the rules.
Right.
But I'm telling you, John, he walked out on the stage and did a front double bicep, a side chest pose, and a back double bicep. And that was it. He walked off. But he brought the house down. I mean, everybody stood up and clapped. I mean, he won that show easily.
Wow. Isn't that amazing how good he was as a teenager?
Yep.
Yeah, I've talked to him, and I talked to Boyer a couple times, and he talked about how he used to go to different states and compete when he was a teenager, and his dad would drive him to all these different places. So, yeah, he had a lot of success as a teenager.
Yeah, he had a dad. I remember seeing his dad multiple times. He was about 5'7" and weighed 140 pounds. He was
no kidding.
He was very lean, and I don't think his dad worked out at all. Yeah.
Yeah, he told me a story about when he found out he had that split in his bicep, and he showed his dad, and his dad said, "Let me see." And his dad went like this, and his dad had the split in the bicep too. Without even working out.
Yeah, well, Boyer was he was such a great guy. I still talk to him every once in a while on the internet.
Uh-huh.
I think he's in California, and he's pretty close to 75 years old now. I'm 77. He's probably 73 or 4.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Tell me about that 1966 Mr. USA, because Dennis Tinarino was in that, and Boyer and Jim Haslop. There are a lot of future stars in that sport.
That was an interesting contest. I remember I entered, I don't know, maybe I was 10th or 11th, and my buddy there in Waco, Ed Cook, he entered as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, Boyer got second and Haslop got third and Tinarino, like you said, won.
Right, exactly.
Of course, I thought Boyer should have won.
Okay.
When you look at the pictures, Tinarino had a real good physique. And, you know, back in those days, to win the Mr. USA or to win the Mr. America, you sort of had to work your way up.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know. It seemed like the judges remained the same and the contestants were sort of the same each year.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't just jump in, even if you had the best physique, and win a contest. So Barrier had to work his way up.
Okay. It's like paying your dues, right? You just had to keep showing up, and then they moved you up the
ladder. I remember Barrier told me when Jim Haislip won the Mr. America in 68.
Yeah.
He got the most applause, and he should have won that year.
Right.
But he didn't. He got second. And the next year, a lot of people thought Barrier was not as good in 69 as he was in 68.
Okay.
And maybe Chris Dickerson should have won in 69, but he didn't. He got second, and Barrier won first in 69.
You were in that show too, right? You were in that
show.
Yeah,
that was a good show. Those old school bodybuilding shows on the national level were a lot different then than they are now. You know, you didn't have any music, and they did have prejudging and some body part divisions.
Mm-hmm.
And most people were, you could talk to them. They were friendly, and all the guys got along. Now, from what I hear today or in the last 15 years, it's so competitive and I'm not sure of the word, but the guys don't, the communication is not open and friendly and pat you on the back and that sort of thing like it used to be. So I had a lot of fun entering those contests in the 60s and 70s. It was fun.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I talked to Boyer and Chris Dickerson, too, and they said the guys would all get together. Nobody had any money, so they'd all share a room. There'd be, like, three or four guys in a room, and then they'd all go out to eat afterwards and stuff. It sounded like a really good time back then, you know?
Yeah, it was. It was.
Yeah. Tell me about that 69 America, then, that one that you just mentioned, Ellington. Because what did you think of Ken Waller? Because he was a new guy on the scene, right?
Yeah, he was. I had entered against Waller in the Junior Mr. U.S. contest in, I think it was Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
A year or two before, and he won, and I got third place. I'm trying to remember who got second. He was a fellow from North Carolina. Yeah, Waller had Waller was unusual because I know enough about genetics and fat cells to be able to state that people who have blonde hair, blue eyes, and freckles,
mm-hmm.
their ancestors came from the colder regions of the world, so they are born with several times as many fat cells.
Oh, that's interesting.
So Waller, you know, he had almost red hair, blue eyes, and freckled skin.
Yeah.
So it was pretty difficult to getting a suntan. And he was at some disadvantages as far as getting lean. But he certainly achieved some good goals. Yeah, he got, let's see, in 69. I'm not sure how he placed in the Mr. America in 69. And 70.
He got third. He got
second. Second, I believe, didn't he?
Boyer was first, Chris Dickerson was second, and Ken was third.
Was he in 69?
Yeah, 69, yeah.
Yeah. Have you interviewed him?
No, I've been trying to get a hold of him for the longest time, but I guess he doesn't really like doing interviews, I guess. And last time I talked to Boyer, he gave me his email address, and I emailed him, but he never responded.
I see.
Have you talked to him recently?
No, I liked Ken Waller.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Arthur Jones didn't care much for him because Ken and Casey Viator were the favorites for the 1971 contest. So Arthur certainly did not want Waller to appear in great shape.
Right, right.
He kept pushing Casey, I remember, during his workouts by Colin Waller a red-headed bastard, you know. Better train hard, Casey, or that red-headed bastard's going to beat you.
Did you know Arthur Jones back then, Ellington?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I met Arthur in 1970.
Okay.
He had his headquarters in Lake Helen, Florida, and I was at Tallahassee at Florida State then.
Okay.
And that was about 150 or 60 miles from Tallahassee. So after I met Arthur in the summer of 1970, I would drive down and visit with him. And
okay.
He was training Casey during at least a 4 or 5 month period of time before the 1971 Mr. America show. So I watched him train Casey several times.
Okay. Did you try the Nautilus training also?
Yeah. Yeah, it opened my eyes, I tell you. I started training in his high-intensity fashion in 1971 and have continued to do that ever since.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
So before that, were you training like 6 days a week, lots of volume, like a lot of the bodybuilding?
Yeah, I do the split routines and usually three sets of 10 or 12 exercises, so my workout would take at least an hour.
Yeah.
And when I met Arthur, you know, we trimmed it down to 20, 25 minutes
mm-hmm.
three times a week.
Okay.
That was kind of hard to do back then, but if you did those train-to-fatigue sets correctly,
mm-hmm.
Arthur Jones was right, man. It was hard to go through more than about 12 exercises that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Arthur back then, he was doing full body workouts, right? So you were training your whole body in one workout. Yeah.
Yeah, you started with the largest muscles and finished with the smaller muscles. So his famous leg workout was a leg press for 20 reps followed by leg extensions, followed by full squats with a barbell. And
wow.
It took me about 6 weeks of doing that in Tallahassee to go down and do it in front of Arthur Jones in DeLand. And but I got to where I could do it and do the last exercise, which was a barbell squat with 315 pounds.
Wow, you did 315 after all the other stuff before.
Yeah, Casey would do 500 and something.
So. Gee, really? Wow. And
he was phenomenal back then.
And he was 19 years old, right? At the time.
Yeah, and just I remember the before he won the Mr. America, I watched him train. I guess it was two or three nights before the contest.
Mm-hmm.
And Arthur had him take off his shirt at the end of the workout. I remember he did about 25 dips. That was his last exercise.
Okay.
And this was after working his arms to exhaustion, you know?
Yeah.
On Arthur's bicep tricep machine. And Arthur had him take off his shirt and do some poses. Gosh, his... From front to back, it seemed like it was about 2 feet thick in his arms and shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the sweat was just rolling off of him, but I've never seen such thickness and muscularity as he had.
Yeah. Wow, what a phenomenon.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about those workouts, Ellington, because I've heard some people talk about it, like how Arthur used to do it. You would basically train your whole body in one workout, but you're just doing one set. And like Arthur was doing it, he was doing three exercises for legs. Did he do that with all the body parts? Did he combine exercises for chest and back to completely exhaust the muscle?
Sometimes he did. Sometimes he only did one set for body part. when he trained Casey and the other bodybuilders he was dealing with, Sergio Oliva was one of them.
Okay.
He wouldn't tell them what he was going to do. And you might do two workouts in a row following the same order, but mm-hmm. then he would start switching things around. And so you didn't know what to expect. And boy, they were brutal. But he seldom used more than 12 exercises.
Okay.
You might do 14 if the last couple of exercises were something small like wrist curls.
Yeah. Okay.
But Arthur always liked chins and dips.
Mm-hmm.
So the way you really surprise a bodybuilder that would come from out of town and visit was you'd have him do as many chin-ups as possible. That's his first exercise.
Okay.
Chin-ups. And you know, most guys that weigh over 200 pounds, chin-ups kill them.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen a guy that weighed over 200 pounds that was good at chins.
Right.
You know, like Boyer, when he weighed 180 or 185, he could probably do 30 chin-ups. But, man, he had these huge arms.
Yeah.
And I've seen some other guys in Texas, Ronnie Ray, who was a champion bench presser. Before he was a champion bench presser, he had huge arms, and he was only like 5 foot tall and weighed 140 pounds, but he could do 33 chin-ups.
Okay.
So Arthur was good at chin-ups. I think he could do 15 chin-ups at one.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's the way you put a big guy down.
Yeah.
You know, you start him off on something that you'd think these big guys could do chin-ups, but they can't.
Yeah.
So you put them on that and they only do six, you know, and then you start harassing them, calling them names because they can't do very many chin-ups, and then the workout goes downhill. So now over a meal after that, now they're going to listen to you, you know, because they couldn't believe they couldn't do more than six chin-ups.
Yeah. How did you get along with Arthur? Because I heard he was difficult to get along with his personality.
A lot of people couldn't get along with him. I don't know. I blended okay with him. I never, and you know, I worked for him for almost 20 years.
Wow.
And he got upset at me two or three times over something I did, not related to workouts, but something else. But all you had to do in dealing with Arthur is just say, Arthur, I was wrong. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done that. And he'd let it go.
Mm-hmm.
But if you tried to argue with him, or if you said, no, I didn't do that, or if you tried to pull a fast one on him, then he would earmark you as being not the type of guy that he wanted around. And then you would get harassed unbelievably.
Okay.
I got along fine with him. Learned a lot from him.
Yeah. He seemed like a real character. Did he have all those reptiles at his farm back then when you were visiting him? In the early 70s?
Yeah, he sure did. He had a big alligator on the side of his office and eventually had 40 or 50 or more of them.
Mm-hmm.
And got into big snakes and finally had about 70 elephants and a big gorilla. So
holy cow.
He liked big bodybuilders and he liked big animals and things done in a big way.
Yeah.
Oh.
And Arthur was against steroids too, wasn't he? He thought
it was
natural, yeah.
Very much so.
That's interesting.
He just didn't think you needed them. Of course, later on, you know, 25 years later, I don't think he realized that the bodybuilders that were involved were taking such massive amounts.
Yeah.
And, you know, the research that was done by the medical community back in the 70s and 80s only used the small amounts
mm-hmm.
of testosterone and other hormones. And when they did that, they didn't get much in the way of muscle-building results, you know.
Yeah.
So the scientific idea was that they don't help very much.
Mm-hmm. Right. What was the kind of use that they were using back in the 60s and 70s? How much were guys using back then?
Well, I remember the drug of choice was Dianabol. It seems like the power lifters seemed to be into it more than the bodybuilders were.
Okay.
But I don't think anybody involved in powerlifting was taking more than, 15, 20 milligrams, you know, those small pills a day.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it seems today, when I talk to some of the bodybuilders today, the current bodybuilders, a lot of them are using a lot of testosterone. And when I got involved in bodybuilding in the late 70s, it seemed like testosterone was more for like the football players, powerlifters, and the bodybuilders, like you said, they use more Dianabol and Decadrabol and things like that. But it seems like everybody now is using a lot of testosterone, like really high dosages of that.
Yeah. Well, I didn't want to get involved with it back then, and I certainly didn't want to even come close to Arthur Jones thinking that I was involved with it. So,
right.
Arthur would have pistol whipped just about anybody that came through there that was taking any kind of drugs, including smoking marijuana.
Yeah, he was really against that too, yeah. Yeah, I want to ask you about genetics. I think you've written about this in your books, and you just mentioned it a few minutes ago. When you look at some of those bodybuilders that we talked about, like Boyer Coe and Casey Vidor and Sergio Oliva, what would you say about the – how would you determine the genetics of those guys? Would you go by, like, bone structure, muscle cells, the attachments, things like that?
Well, it's mostly the length of the muscle itself, the contractile tissue.
Okay.
And it's like Arthur used to say, once you understand what to look for, and you got to have a fairly lean individual to begin with where you can see, where the muscles attach to the tendons. But he said it was just like beef cattle or looking at horses. If you know what to look for, you can tell it at a fairly early age, and you can direct people in the right direction. You know, there was a guy that wrote a book 10 or 15 years ago. It was called Athletes. And he went to the Olympics, and he took pictures of most of the athletes in posing trunks.
Okay.
And he had everything from ping pong all the way up to bodybuilders and weightlifters, soccer players. And you could line all these people up, and you could see at a glance the fact, you didn't have to even measure people to know that tall athletes do well in basketball, short athletes do well in gymnastics,
mm-hmm.
medium athletes do well in a lot of different sports. And then you could just see the classifications and how these champion Olympic athletes look different, you know, sport by sport.
Yeah.
And Arthur used to say that genetics are not the key factor in sports. Genetics are the key factor in everything you do.
Hmm.
You know, said from the way you think to the shape of your body to your actions.
Wow. Hmm.
So he was an expert at picking out genetically gifted people.
Yeah.
To go through his programs. Now, here's something you'd be interested in, John.
Okay.
We did a West Point study in 1975, and the athletes that he chose for the study were football players, and he lined up all the football players along the wall. But the deciding factor was he had them sit down on the floor next to the wall, because he said the best football players, especially linemen, are the tallest ones seated.
Hmm.
And it just so happens that Dick Butkus, you know, the all-pro middle linebacker from the Chicago Bears, which you can still go on the internet and put in his name, and you'll get a 30-minute look at the ferocious hits that he had when he was playing for the Bears. You know, I mean, it was something.
Yeah.
But Dick Butkus was 6 feet tall seated.
Wow. Okay.
Now, that means that you got long arms and short legs.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, from a linebacker's point of view, that's what you want, because you have a hard time knocking a guy off his feet that has long arms and short legs, you know?
Wow.
And, you know, Jones said that Butkus was built like a gorilla, because Arthur had a 400-pound gorilla.
Mm-hmm.
That if you've ever seen a gorilla up close, they got short legs, you know.
Right, right.
Seated or standing, they're about the same height.
Right.
But, oh, man, they got these huge hands and forearms and you know, just upper body muscles.
Right.
I remember one time he had to get the gorilla's teeth cleaned. And the gorilla was, you know, going through decay or whatever. So he had to drug the gorilla and get one of the key dental professionals from the University of Florida to come over and give the gorilla a tooth examination and clean his teeth, you know. And
right.
He told the guy, you only got 30 minutes to work on this gorilla, you know. But while he was working on that gorilla, Arthur measured the gorilla's neck 33 inches.
Wow.
Now, the gorilla weighed 400 pounds, and its wrist was 13 inches.
Wow. Unbelievable.
And he took some handprints of the gorilla, and it was interesting. The handprint of the gorilla was bigger, but not much bigger than Dick Butkus's hand.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Crazy.
So, you know, one of my good friends, Kim Wood, was a strength training coach of the Cincinnati Bengals for like 30 years.
Right.
And he always said professional football, for the line people, is played with your hands. You know, man, you got to have strong, strong hands.
Hmm.
And he said there was a guy that played for the Bengals one year. His name was Bob Brown. And he weighed about 350 pounds. And he said Bob played on the defense, was defensive end, but he would slap the helmet of the guy in front of him, sometimes twice, one hand and then the other.
Right.
And said a lot of the men, that would just knock the fire out of most people, you know.
Right.
And he said after doing that for a couple of years, they outlawed it. You can't do that
right. In
the NFL now. But he said Bob Brown was one of the best defensive players he's ever seen. And he had such strong hands, wrists, and forearms.
Wow, crazy.
Yeah.
What did you think of the genetics of Sergio Oliva when you met him?
Oh, they were fantastic. He had just these long muscles in his forearms, his biceps, his triceps.
Right.
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw him. Casey had the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Casey had these big, I think the most impressive muscle that Casey Viator had was his forearms.
Okay.
I mean, he just had, looked like a football. One side of a football from his thumb right down to his elbow. I mean, you know, his forearm came out.
Jeez.
Huge.
Yeah.
And Sergio had the same thing. And Arthur always said that Sergio's arms would have contracted beyond what he measured them. And I think it was 20 and a fourth. If they would have actually been bigger than that, if he could have contracted them fully, but he couldn't because his forearm ran into his bicep. You know,
he
couldn't come up another 15 degrees
right.
to get a full peak on his bicep.
Yeah. Yeah, Sergio was like, he's one of the few bodybuilders that had every muscle group was fully developed. He didn't have any weak muscle groups.
Yeah, you're right. He was something to look at. You know, just he had unusual symmetry to have such huge muscles
and that tiny waist, right?
A tiny waist, And, you know, he was an Olympic, a champion Olympic lifter.
Right, right.
Before he got into bodybuilding. I mean, he was a beautifully developed weightlifter.
Yeah.
The first weightlifting contest and bodybuilding show I ever saw, it was like in 1960 in Houston, Texas. I was like a sophomore in high school. I went down with a buddy of mine, and when we walked in, John Gergott, do you remember him?
Remember the name, yeah.
He was from Louisiana, and he got like third in one Mr. America contest, probably in 67 or 8 or something around there. But he was doing an Olympic press with over 300 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And he also won the bodybuilding show.
Okay.
And I went, he had a beautifully developed physique, very impressive, as he did cleans and jerks and snatches.
Yeah.
And he weighed right at 198 pounds. But backstage warming up for the contest, I saw him do 3 one-arm chins with each hand. And he was also good friends with Boyer Coe. Boyer could do a couple of one-arm chins with each hand.
Yeah.
And but he had a real good physique and probably should have done better in the Miss America than he did for several years, but didn't. So,
yeah, I remember you mentioned Arthur measuring Sergio's arms as 20 and a quarter. And I remember that was famous. That was a famous story for a while where he measured, I think, Sergio and probably Casey. And he also measured Arnold Schwarzenegger and I think Rumble when they came to visit. And I heard Arnold was pissed off because his arm measured smaller than he thought it was.
Well, the way Arthur would measure your arm, it was smaller than you thought because you measured it the wrong way. Arthur would always say, if you got a standard tape measure, you got to pull it tight, but the thickness of the tape measure makes you over measure your arm, you know, because the tape numbers go on the outside.
Yeah.
So you can put a micrometer on a tape measure and accurately figure out how much to subtract from your arm depending on what that number is. But what Arthur would do, he would take a newspaper and he would cut out a strip of newspaper about 24 inches long.
Okay.
And he would take a steel rule and measure off on there 15, 16, 17, 18, 19 inches. And because of the thinness of that newspaper was much thinner than a plastic tape, you would get a more accurate version of what that arm measured.
Okay.
And so it turned out most of these bodybuilders had 3/4 or an inch smaller arm than they thought.
Right, right. That's interesting.
And I'm not sure Boyer's arm measured more than 18. I think Mike Mincer's was a little over 18.
Yeah.
Casey's, I think, was almost 19 and a half. And Arnold's, I don't know if Arnold was as big as Casey's, but it was close to it, probably 19 and a half.
Okay.
And that would deflate a lot. And a bunch of bodybuilders would come down and their arms were 16, you know, and they were claiming 18-inch arms.
Right.
Well, Arthur got to where he could look at an arm and tell how much it measured.
Yeah.
And here's something that'll interest you, but he always said Sergio, his arm was built like a bowling ball.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you could cut it across the middle, it would be round.
Right.
Now, he said Boyer's arm, on the other hand, it many times looked as big as Sergio's, but Boyer had an arm that was shaped like a pancake.
Okay.
You know, it wasn't thick.
Yeah.
Side to side, but it was thick across, you know.
Uh-huh.
And he had that split bicep, and Wow, it looked, Barrier's arm measured less than it looked.
Yeah, exactly. And
Sergio's arm, I mean, it was just huge. But it was round. If it was built like Barrier, it would look right. Look 2 inches bigger, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, Sergio's arms looked bigger than his head when he had a front double bicep.
Yeah, he had a small head.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
And Arthur always said, you know, bodybuilding, especially in posing, you got to always take the relationship of the head to the body. And the people who looked the biggest on stage were the ones that had the smallest heads.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people didn't have small heads. Casey had a large head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you got to have a head appropriate to your body.
Right, right.
To make the right impact, I suppose, or to give you an advantage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you got a big head, John.
Do I? Maybe it looks like it in front of
the... That's probably why you never won the Mr. Olympia, see?
Yeah, probably.
How do you shrink your head? I don't know.
Yeah, I look at bodybuilder structures all the time, I guess because I come from the early days of bodybuilding in the 70s and 80s, you know. So whenever I see a new bodybuilder, I'll look at how long their torso is compared to their legs, and I'll look at the different muscle shapes and stuff. And it's kind of morphed now with bodybuilding because the guys take so many drugs and they're actually injecting oil into different muscle groups. They don't have any weak muscle groups anymore because they're just, if they have a weak muscle, they just inject oil into it to build it up, you know. So
yeah, and none of them seem to really stand out in a commanding manner.
Right.
Like the guys in the 70s and the 80s did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, like you said, when you take growth hormone, from what I've read,
mm-hmm.
you get growth of the skeletal muscles, but you also get growth of the liver and the spleen and
and
even the stomach. You know, it's an internal organ, so you get these distorted looks.
Yeah, yeah.
That I don't know. They're distorted looks.
Yeah. That's one of the things I loved about the bodybuilders of the old days was everybody had a unique look. Everybody had unique muscle shapes, unique structure, and you could tell them all apart. You know, if you ever saw them in a lineup, like when you do the Mr. Olympia with the silhouettes, you could easily determine who each guy was.
They had personalities that were different.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You know, they were, and seems like all of them were approachable, you know?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Even Dorian Yates, have you met him in person?
Oh, yeah, I've interviewed him. He's a great guy.
Yeah, he's a real great guy. And I don't know. He read Arthur Jones' stuff. He read some of my stuff.
Right.
And he trained in a high-intensity fashion for many, many years on most of his exercises. So he had a good handle. And you could approach him and, boy, I tell you, I've always had a good eye like you have.
Mm-hmm.
For watching contests and judging them. Well, the first time I saw Dorian in person, seems like it was in, maybe it was in 94 in Atlanta at the Mr. Olympia.
Yeah.
Now, were you there? Did you watch that? It was the first time, I believe, they had the Mr. Olympia 2 or 3 years in a row in Atlanta.
Right, I remember that, yeah.
And this was, I believe it was the first year. Maybe it was the second.
93 was the first year, I think, they did it. Yeah.
But I went down front to watch the contest, the prejudging, because my photography buddy, Chris Lunn, was mm-hmm. right down there in the front area taking pictures. So I went down and slipped under the ropes, and Chris got me a chair to sit by.
Okay.
So, you know, I was 12, 15 feet from the stage to watch the guys.
Yeah.
And Dorian came out, and I remember his, when he posed his legs, boy, he would take the right leg and slam the heel down mm-hmm. on the floor. And then he'd do the same thing with the left leg. And when he did that, man, the muscles would just ripple.
Right.
And that was the start of his posing routine.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember when when he finished and the other guys finished, this was during the prejudging, Chris said, well, I think Dorian's got it. And I said, you're right. And Chris said, he did a good job of hiding that torn bicep, didn't he? And I said, what are you talking about, Chris? And he said, well, he can't contract. You know, he had torn his bicep like 2 weeks before.
Right.
He didn't want surgery on it. So that thing was rolled up in his right arm.
Yeah.
Near his shoulder.
Right.
And so he comes out again that night, and I'm looking at that right arm now, and I can see what Chris was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But even with my experienced eye, I didn't notice it.
Wow.
I didn't notice it during the prejudging. I mean, he hit it so well.
Yeah.
And was in and out of his double bicep pose and distracted everybody with his legs whamming, you know, that he won the contest hands down, and mentioned the torn bicep in his speech after winning the trophy, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I thought was unusual. But anyway, Dorian, he had a heck of a physique, you know.
Yeah, he sure did. He's a great interview, too. He's really his bodybuilding career and stuff. What did you think of Mike Mentzer when you met him?
Well, I met Mike early on after Mike had seen Casey win the 71 Mr. America. He came down. I started working with Arthur Jones in the summer of 1973.
Okay.
And Mike came down about a month after I'd been there. And I took some pictures of him, and he was talkative, and he was very interested in Arthur Jones training him. And so I kept in touch with him, and had him write some introductions to some of my bodybuilding books that I wrote 5 or 6 years later.
Okay.
And I visited him in Los Angeles a couple of times. And Mike took me over to Joe Weider's headquarters in, I believe it was 1977 or 78.
Okay.
And I took some pictures of Mike training on Nautilus equipment at Sean Harrington's gym near UCLA and used them in some of my books. He was in terrific shape then.
Okay.
And I think it was 78 he went on and won either Weider's, probably Mr. America contest, didn't he?
He won the Universe. There. Yeah, he won the Universe in 78. That's where
so, I would hear bits and pieces about Mike, and he and Ray came down several years later, and Arthur decided to hire them.
Okay.
And I thought, man, this is going to be a great opportunity for me to do some stuff with Mike. And Mike and Ray worked at the Nautilus plant in Lake Helen for about a year and a half.
Okay.
And we had a gym up on the hill. We had all these television studios in the back, and Mike and Ray stayed in the back. And John, in that whole year and a half period, Mike Mentzer never came into my office and talked to me.
Wow.
Never asked me anything about bodybuilding. And but Ray, his brother, came in frequently. I trained Ray a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Mike, this was after he had lost the Olympia to Arnold.
Right.
What year was that? 81 or 82?
1980.
Well, it was just after that. And he was bitter. He was, I don't know what type of influence the drugs had on him.
Mm-hmm.
But he was not the same as I remember back in 77 and 78 and throughout the 70s.
Wow.
And Arthur ended up firing both Mike and Ray because he couldn't get consistent work out of either one of them.
Wow.
So it was
Yeah, that contact really messed him up. You know, it seemed like it messed up the rest of his life, you know.
Now, Ray may have been the strongest bodybuilder I ever trained. Ray and Casey.
Really?
Yeah, Ray was, he was very strong. And at that time, he weighed about 260 pounds. And professional bodybuilding at that time, you didn't have anybody weighing 260 pounds.
Right.
Ray was the first guy that weighed that much. And I remember the old school guy, Vic Tanney, who started gyms all over the United States and had the first muscle building gym in Los Angeles back in the 40s.
Wow.
Vic Tanney, he visited us. And I remember him saying about Ray, oh my gosh, if Ray would have been walking Muscle Beach in the 40s, it would have been, you know, people wouldn't have believed that he could have, he was that big.
Yeah, yeah. I heard a lot.
Close to Steve Reeves and some of those other guys back then, as well as his brother, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard that about Ray. I heard he was really a big, big guy, really good genetics for strength and size. And his arms were really big too, right?
I measured his arms at over 20 inches, yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of tragic how they both died together.
Yeah, it was.
I see you won the Collegiate Mr. America in 1972. That was probably your biggest title, right, Ellington?
Yes, that was in Fort Worth, Texas. And I guess I was probably in the best shape of my life. I think I weighed about 195.
Okay.
5'11". I've got some good pictures taken about that time that, you know, I was at Florida State University.
Okay.
When that happened, and that was in April of 1972. And I got a PhD from the College of Education that June, a couple of months later.
Wow. Okay.
So and then I went to work with Arthur Jones and stayed with him for 20 years. But recently, one of my buddies nominated me for the Distinguished Alumni Award at Florida State.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
And I won.
Did you? Wow, that's great.
So normally, a winner of this award would come to Tallahassee at Florida State University during the homecoming football game and go out and be given a trophy at the halftime.
Yeah.
Well, not this year. So they're going to do a virtual award ceremony.
Oh, okay.
Like we're doing now.
Yeah.
Zoom.
Yeah.
So, which is all right. But anyway, I have a very nice black and white photograph that I had made several days after I won that trophy in April of 1972. I located that black and white negative because the woman in charge at Florida State wanted to see some old pictures from 1972 and when I got my PhD.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So I sent the negative to Tim Patterson, who's a good friend of mine that runs T-Nation out of Colorado Springs. And Tim has some experts that can take black and white negatives, and this has scratches all over it and whatnot. And they did. They revived that 1972 negative.
Wow.
And sent me a 3-foot tall print of it, and it's fantastic, even if I say so. You know, so I'm going to send that to Florida State University.
At least you do it next year. Hopefully, if they have the football games next year, they should.
Well, she said they might do that.
Yeah, they should. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I saw you made a lot of magazine covers back in the day. I was looking at some of your stuff on the internet.
Yeah, I had when I was at Florida State. There was a photographer friend of mine, and I'd go over and talk to him, and he was real creative. And he made a lot of suggestions on, let's do some pictures of you that you don't ordinarily see on most of these muscle magazines.
And, okay.
You know, there was a guy in Tampa that used to take pictures of Haislip. Dick Falcon was his name.
I remember
him.
Yeah, sure.
Dick was not creative at all. He would take all of his physique shots on Tampa Bay with a palm tree in the back,
mm-hmm.
in the same location, you know, a couple of buildings over here.
Right.
And all of Haislip's pictures that he got on the front of Muscle Development or Strength and Health were taken at the same spot, in the same way with the other bodybuilders from
right.
Florida.
Right.
So I said, I'm going to do some things different, and I did. And I had pictures taken in a tree. I had typical beach shots, but rocks, you know, there were some nice rock formations in a beach called Panacea that was near Tallahassee. And then I got some pictures with girls doing leapfrogs over my shoulders.
Yeah, yeah.
Some jogging pictures. And we had a good time doing some different stuff.
Yeah, right. That's interesting.
And John Grimmick at Muscle Development, and trying to think who the other guy name was. It was the key editor-in-chief at Strength and Health. Was his name Holbrook?
I'm not sure.
But anyway, they liked what I was sending them. So I had three or four nice covers on Strength and Health, and I think two on Muscular Development, and a couple on other magazines.
Okay, awesome.
That was a fun time, yeah.
Yeah. Now, how many books have you written, Ellington?
Now, I like to write books.
Okay.
That's one thing Arthur wanted me to do. He said, I want to bring you in here. You like to write.
Yeah.
Do as many magazine articles, send them around. So I think if you look at all the editions, I've written 75 or 76. I've got a shelf over here.
Yeah.
Right behind me. On the left-hand side are normal books. On the right-hand side, those are all books I've written.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, I like to write books. And, you know, I've got an 18-year-old son.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't like to read.
Right.
And I've trained him 500 times, and he hasn't read one page in any of my books.
But
he uses a phone. You know, he lost his phone. He's at Florida State now.
Okay.
He lost his phone 2 days ago, and he's just been going haywire. We got to get him a new phone. You know, get it. Well, it takes about 3 or 4 days to do that.
Right.
But if he can't put it on his phone, he's not going to read it.
Right, I know.
Yeah, isn't that something?
Yeah, it's a lost art reading books. I know, it's a shame.
Yeah, it really is. You know, there's an interesting story about reading and writing. When I started to work with Arthur Jones, a writer from Sports Illustrated visited the Nautilus headquarters.
Okay.
It must have been in 74 or 75. His name was Barry McDermott. And he wanted to do a big Sports Illustration article on Arthur Jones.
Yeah.
He did. It appeared, you know, months later in a spring issue of Sports Illustrated, and it was called See You Later, Alligator, I think. Something like that. Kind of had a humorous title.
Yeah.
But I trained Barry 4 or 5 times while he visited the Nautilus headquarters. And I was very interested in writing articles for major magazines. And I asked Barry, I said, you know, Barry, how do you put together your material for Sports Illustrated? Because, man, Sports Illustrated was a huge circulating magazine then.
Yeah.
And he said, well, you got to have a good lead sentence. And I said, well, how are you, what's your lead sentence in this Arthur Jones material that you're putting together?
Mm-hmm.
And he had been all over with Arthur, interviewing friends of Arthur's and enemies of Arthur's, and he was well into this for about 6 weeks.
Okay.
And here's what his lead sentence was. He speaks in capital letters. Now, if you've ever seen Arthur Jones in person, or if you've ever seen any of his videos on on YouTube or whatever, you immediately remember that baritone voice of Arthur Jones.
Right, right.
Arthur could dominate a room with 50 people in it. And I thought, my, that is a good lead sentence, you know. He speaks in capital letters, and that's exactly what Arthur did. Yeah. Now, I don't think when the article appeared in Sports Illustrated, I think it had been edited out, or maybe it was in the middle of the article, but I think they got off on the alligators and crocodiles right at the beginning.
Oh, okay.
But I learned a lot from that. I learned, and I still think about, man, you got to have a good opening sentence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In every article you write and in every chapter of books you write, you got to hook people right from the start.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And that's especially the case on the internet now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because the attention span is so low. But that was a perfect leading line for Arthur Jones, because it encapsulated his personality perfectly, you know, in one line, in one sentence.
Yeah, he could really entertain groups or entertain you or anybody.
Yeah.
With his, with the way he talked, just the sound of his staccato voice and the interesting stories that the man had.
Yeah, yeah. He seemed like a really interesting, remarkable person, you know.
You know, whatever, if you recorded in 3 minutes the most interesting thing that's ever happened in your life, if you could put that in a 3-minute recording,
right?
And I did the same thing, and we think, man, these are pretty exciting stories or adventures.
Yeah.
Arthur had done 500 things that were more adventuresome and exciting than anything that you and me and other people have done.
Right, right.
And furthermore, he's alive to tell about it. You know, a lot of these things, maybe some people had done or attempted, but they didn't live through it, you know?
Right, right.
And he did.
Yeah. They should make a movie about his life. That would be fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he told me right before he died, he said, and this was in August of 2007. He told me, he said, "El, forget about me." He said, "Nobody's going to remember me in 10 years. I'll be forgotten." And, Tim Patterson says his big T Nation website that most people that go on there, and they're young people, you know, from 15 to 25 mostly.
Yeah.
They never heard of Arthur Jones. They don't know who Arthur Jones is.
Wow, that's a shame.
And, it's a shame, man. It's like, you know, John, if you and I die, you think they're going to remember who we are 10 years from now? No. So you better do some living now.
Right.
And make your mark, because it's going to be over when you die.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So what are you doing now at LinkedIn with your time?
Well, I've got a couple of books I'm working on. And they're ebooks. So I had a website for 20 years that Tim Patterson in Colorado Springs built for me.
Okay.
At the same time, he put together his T Nation and all his food stuff. Well, he recently took all my information off of my drdarden.com website and put it into a forum on his T Nation website now.
Oh, okay.
So that's where I'm going to be answering questions and reporting my endeavors.
Okay.
On Ellington Darden's forum on T Nation. So I just started it a week ago.
Oh, really?
I'm going to try to come out with several 50-page ebooks.
Okay.
And the first one is probably going to be about backloading, which is a word that I kind of thought of for the negative, you know, when you stand and do a curl, the lifting part could be called a front load and the lowering part could be called a back load.
Okay.
So I've got a half a dozen of new negative training techniques that I'm going to talk about and reveal in this new book called Backloading.
Okay.
Negative training techniques.
I'll have to go on that forum and mention our interview when we get it done, when I put it up.
So yeah, people, do that.
Yeah. Okay.
So how does your website work here with these Zoom broadcast or pods or whatever?
Yeah, I started the podcast 3 years ago. Before that, I was doing occasional interviews with some of the big names like Boyer Coe, Chris Dickerson, some of the old legends. And we would do Skype interviews that were like 2 hours long about their whole career. And I would throw in pictures of them, you know, from the old day.
Yeah.
Videos, if I had the videos. So from there, I decided to start a weekly podcast. So we started the podcast 3 years ago in 2017. And now more recently, I've been doing the interviews on Zoom. So I'm able to take it also and put it on YouTube. So now we have a podcast, audio, and then we also have it on YouTube. And then on YouTube, I'm able again to add some pictures and some videos and things like that. So I got the YouTube and then I got the podcast. So two different things.
So you can reach a pretty good audience with these Zoom interviews now, huh?
Yeah. The audience is building. You know, people really love them because I don't think nobody's really talking about the old days. There's a lot of YouTube channels on bodybuilding talking about what's going on now, the current contest, the current guys. But not too many people are talking about the old bodybuilders. And we're losing a lot of these guys. You know, a lot of them are passing away.
Yeah, right.
I'm trying to interview them before they go because I want to hear the stories from them so I can hear the exactly what happened. It's not just something you read on the internet, but you're hearing it from the horse's mouth, you know?
Well, you know, it's interesting because most of the money put in marketing today, they push new. I mean, you got to have something that's NEW, that's new and different.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, a lot of the readers and the listeners, they don't realize that a lot of the old concepts, the old routines, old diets, for example, were very effective and probably something you could do in a more efficient manner than all the new stuff today.
Yeah, yeah.
So just because old is connected to it doesn't mean that it's obsolete or outdated or doesn't work.
Right.
Because, you know, my diet that I have people on to lose fat is right from the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
But my gosh, does it work? I mean, you know, with the before and after pictures in the archives of people and measurements and photographs that I have now, you know, compared to what's available today, my stuff works three or four times better.
Wow, really?
Yeah, but it's hard to get that across to young people who want the latest.
Yeah.
The latest and greatest.
You'll have to put a new spin on it and say it's a new diet.
Yeah.
Then people will be interested in it.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
New is a good word. It's one of the top 10 words in advertising.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Old is not, well, you know, Patterson told me that old school training, that concept is making a comeback on his website.
Oh, okay, good. So yeah.
More and more people seem to be interested in, just like you're saying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What happened in the 70s and 80s?
Right. And then
in the 40s and 50s and 60s, you know, how old are you, John?
57.
57. So you never had a chance to visit the old Muscle Beach in the 50s. But I went out there in 1963. It was just after the original Muscle Beach closed, but everything had been moved to Venice.
Okay.
And it was much the same. And I had a great time. And I went back 4 or 5 years later, and it was gone.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It had been modernized, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if you go through the internet and look at a lot of the old pictures from the 40s and 50s that were taken on Muscle Beach during contests or during competitions, boy, you just get excited looking at the way people were built and the faces of the crowd that was there. You know, they had 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people that would show up on a weekend and watch these guys train.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah.
Was that the one that was in Santa Monica? The original? The
original one was in Santa Monica, not far from the pier. The
right.
one I visited was in Venice, which was a couple of miles down.
Okay, yeah.
South of Santa Monica.
Right.
But
right.
near the original Gold's Gym.
Right, right.
Which is walking distance from there.
Yeah, wow. So your new your ebooks, are you going to self-publish those, or are they going to have a publisher?
No, I'm going to get Tim Patterson to help me put them in PDF form.
Okay.
He knows how to do that and make them available.
Okay.
On the internet. You know, one thing you got to be careful of is you don't want people to take an ebook and be able to send it to all their friends.
Yeah.
At least I don't.
Yeah.
So he's got a way of making it not, you just can't do that.
Okay. Okay.
I don't know if a standard paper book will ever go completely under, but they certainly don't sell as many hardback or paperback books as they did.
Mm-mm.
You know, 20 years ago. And Patterson was telling me, he said, the bodybuilder types that want ebooks, they don't want them to take up huge amounts of space on their computer or on their phone, you know. They don't right. want more than 50 pages.
Right.
If you can't put it in 50 pages, then don't.
Don't do it.
Don't yeah. do it, yeah. You right. know, somebody once said, I think it was Ernest Hemingway, that it's pretty easy to write 250 words in a story.
Mm-hmm.
But try taking the 250 words and condensing it to 50.
Mm.
Now, a good writer knows how to do that. And 50-word story done the right way is better than a 250-word story or a 1,000-word story
yeah.
if it's done right.
Right.
Yeah. And these the YouTube stuff that you see on videos that go international or whatever, and a lot of the most popular TV programs. I don't know if you've ever watched Criminal Minds.
Criminal Minds, yeah.
yeah, you ever watched that? I mean... Yeah. You know, I've been watching some of them on Netflix,
mm-hmm.
but it's been around for 15 years. And boy, they move fast. You know, you get an opening scene where somebody loses a head or gets a hand cut off with a cleaver.
Right.
I mean, man, they know how to hook you right up front.
Right, right.
And the same thing happens all the way through. You know, I mean, they move fast and they get things done quickly. So
my favorite TV show is The Wire. That was on HBO, but that show builds slowly. It's almost like reading a novel. It takes like 4 episodes before it starts really moving along. And I've tried to get people to watch it, and nobody can watch it. They
yeah.
get interest after first 2 episodes because nobody's getting shot. There's no murders. There's yeah. no action, you know.
Well, my son, when he was about 15, I lassoed him and I said, Tyler, I want you to watch some of the best ever cowboy shows from my Western shows from my upbringing.
Right.
So he said, okay. So I found Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Do you remember that?
Oh yeah. I love that movie. Yeah.
Paul Newman and Robert Redford.
Right.
So we sit down and put that on. John, I'm not kidding you. It moved so slow. Tyler couldn't watch it more than about 15 minutes.
Right.
I couldn't watch it 30 minutes. I don't remember that movie moving slow.
Right, right.
But it certainly did compared to what you see movie-wise today.
Yeah, yeah.
Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. But a lot of times those old movies, they're not like you remember them, you know, no, if you watch them again.
It was a different time back then.
It sure was.
All right, Ellington. Well, thank you for joining me on the show. Appreciate all your old stories, and I wish you the best with your new ebooks, and I hope you keep going because we really appreciate your writing.
Well, thank you, John. I've had a big time, and just remember, man, there's power in the old school, you know, those old ways.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%.
You got to bring them back.
Absolutely. We sure will.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for joining me, and we'll talk again soon, hopefully.
All right.
Take care. All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to Dr. Ellington Darden for taking the time out to do the interview. Next week, we'll be joined by John Taylor. John was a great teenage bodybuilder who actually beat Jeff King at the 1980 Teenage Mr. America contest. He was a light heavyweight, incredible physique. And then John went on to win the Collegiate Mr. America. So we're going to be talking to John Taylor next week. Thanks to Florida Alternative Medicine for continuing to sponsor the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And thanks to all you Patreon donors who contribute cash each month for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. If you're interested in doing that, just go to bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, which is our official website. And in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see the Patreon link. And don't forget about the Fall Fitness Challenge, which is on johnhansonfitness.com. If you guys are interested in entering, it will start next week or October 1st. So you got about a week and a half. So go to johnhansonfitness.com and you can register, and I will write you up a new workout and diet. And you will be in fantastic shape for 2021. How about that? Get rid of 2020 and go into 2021 being in unbelievable condition. If you're not interested in doing it, but you know someone who's interested in doing this or should do it, tell them about it. Just have them go to my website, johnhansonfitness.com, and they can register. All right, that's it for the show. We will see you guys next week. Keep working out. Keep healthy. Keep safe. Take care.